Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. Tonight, we are beginning a new venture on the show called Arthropods 101. So I'm Jonathan Larson. I'm going to be one of your hosts tonight, and I am joined by...
Michael Scavarla, your other host tonight.
And Mike and I, we go way back. We went to Purdue together. Mike's been on the show before, and I thought it would be fun to have Mike on for this initial episode into what is an arthropod. We've talked about all these different things on the show before. The show is named after arthropods, but I don't feel like we've ever really gone into any great detail about what these animals are. And I thought that Mike is an expert on what these things are because Mike is a systematist or a taxonomist. Which do you prefer again?
Both apply. They're related, what they cover. So I go by either.
Okay. Either can be on your business card.
Right.
And why do you think we should be talking about arthropods tonight? Like, why is this an important topic?
Because they're one of the most important groups on the planet. There are, by any measure that you use, there are more arthropods for it. So, for instance, there are more arthropods just by sheer number. If you look at individuals, if you look at weight, they are some of the most important organisms out in the ecosystem doing ecosystem services like pollination or nutrient turnover out in the forests. Really important groups that are often overlooked by most people.
Yeah, they touch our lives in a variety of ways that not everybody always thinks about, I don't think. They're just so omnipresent, but people don't always understand what an arthropod is or what benefits they may provide. Do you think that that's accurate?
Yeah, and I'd also say that not only are they omnipresent, like they're everywhere so people overlook them, but they're also generally pretty small.
That's true.
So unless you're keyed into it, you may just not see them, except for the big showy things like butterflies.
The ones that people like and get tattoos of.
Yeah, or like to eat.
They're
an arthropod that are large and people enjoy, for different reasons.
Charismatic microfauna either get slathered in butter or people get tattoos of them. I think that's what we've established tonight.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So we've been throwing around the word arthropod. What does that mean? Where does that come from?
So arthropod, if you break down the Latin, means jointed foot or joint foot, basically referring to the fact that they have segmented legs.
Okay. And when we are talking about the word arthropod, is that the name for the phylum? And what is a phylum?
Yeah, so the name is Arthropoda.
Okay.
We shorten that in English to arthropod. Like you do any of the other Latin names, you kind of chop off the ending and Englishize it. And yeah, so arthropod is the phylum. To put that into perspective, another phylum that you should be well versed with are the chordates, the things that have a backbone. And so if we're looking at this really high taxonomic level, you've got arthropods, but for humans, we're in chordata, and that includes everything else that has a backbone, like fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and every other mammal. Thinking about it from that kind of grouping, this is a really broad, fairly encompassing category.
When we're talking about phylums, where do they fall? I mean, they're broad, but are they the broadest of broad strokes, or are there things above them?
No, I mean, there's things above them. So there are superphyla. So, for example, arthropods and chordates, what we are in different superphyla. Arthropods are ecdysozoans. This includes things like the arthropods, but also nematodes and some other smaller phyla. And chordates are deuterostomes.
That's a funny word.
It is a funny word. It's based on the fact that when deuterostomes are a blastocyst, which is a small undifferentiated ball of cells. The internal organs, the first invagination of the cells starts from our anus. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
So
in other groups of life, it starts from the mouth.
Ah. And then above these superphylums, what do we have?
So when you get up that high, you're getting into the kingdom level. So these are things like Animalia, which is all animals.
So that's important to remember because I feel like a lot of folks, that aren't entomologists or arthropodologists in this case, I think that they always think of arthropods as sort of not animals. Do you think that that's true?
Yeah, I think people tend to group, when they think of animal, they only think of the chordates or the vertebrates. They don't think of things like arthropods or, you know, clams or oysters or octopuses or any of these other kind of creepy, crawly things that don't have backbones as animals, but, you know, they are.
Right. So we're all in Animalia, but then you start getting to the phylum level and we start separating things out. We've got Chordata for us, and then we've got Arthropoda for our bug friends. And what are the main defining traits that have put them into this category together?
So there's a number of traits that define arthropods. So they, mentioned earlier, they have jointed appendages. They also have exoskeletons. I'm sure many of your viewers have heard of that. This is where they kind of have their skeleton on the outside. That's not to say that all of their skeletons on the outside. They have these invaginations of exoskeleton that go in internally into the body that serve for muscle attachment points. But for the most part, they have this external skeleton.
And it's kind of made up of several layers of wax, right?
Yeah, wax and fat and other things.
Right.
And chitin primarily.
A lot of chitin is in there. And what does the exoskeleton provide the arthropods? Like, why is this an important trait for us to point out?
So I mentioned muscle attachment, but it also has other benefits for arthropods, primarily as protection against desiccation and protection against predation. So it's hard, and it keeps them from drying out and from being eaten. That does, however, put constraints on how big arthropods can get. The exoskeleton can only get so big before it can't support itself.
And that's why we can't have cool, real-life giant bugs.
Pretty much. They would... if you were to have some kind of magic gun that could increase the size of insects to the size that you see in movies, they would be so big that their muscles... and so big and so heavy that their muscles wouldn't be able to move the weight of their exoskeleton, and they would just kind of sit there like a big lump.
But you would still have a giant ant.
You would still have a giant ant. It would just be really useless and not be able to do anything.
You say useless. I say the most impressive paperweight on the planet Earth.
Well, and presuming that a giant ant would taste similar to lobster,
that's a good point.
You could probably eat it.
Yeah. Farms are always looking for new ideas, right?
Yeah.
So we have jointed appendages. That's cool. We have exoskeletons. What are a couple of other things that arthropods have?
So arthropods also have body segmentation.
Okay.
And so if you look at something like a millipede, that would give you a good idea of kind of what the arthropod or the original arthropod looked like. So it's all of these many, many segments that each have an individual appendage on them. And then you've got some of the appendages that have been co-opted into the mouth. And then when you get into other arthropods, you have a phenomenon called tagmosis, where these various body segments have been coalesced into larger segments. So in insects, this is the head, thorax, and abdomen. While in other things like arachnids, you only have two major body segments, the head, and in spiders, the cephalothorax, or the head and the abdomen, rather. And in other arthropods, these tagmata, as they're referred to, use different, collapse different segmentation into different segments.
So how is that different from something like us, though? I mean, I have a head, and I have a chest, and I have legs. So don't I have a segmented body?
You do have those bits, but those bits aren't formed from other segments that have coalesced together.
Okay.
So if you think of something like a grasshopper and you look at the abdomen, it has all these lines that go up and down on the abdomen, and each one of those lines denotes a different segment. So if you were to think of a millipede again, you would collapse the first bunch of segments into the head. the next kind of middle bunch of segments into the thorax of an insect and keep the three pairs of legs there, and then collapse the rest of the segments into the abdomen and then lose all the legs.
Okay. So I'm just a big long meat tube with all these different things that come off of it, and they have these segments that have formed over time is what you're saying.
Right.
Okay. And then is there one last thing that we can mention about some defining traits of arthropoda? Or there are a few more. How many do you want to do?
Well, we can keep going. Just a few more points about body segmentation, if you don't mind.
No, go for it.
The neat thing about segmentation is that, as I kind of alluded to, each one of the segments historically had a leg or some kind of locomotory appendage. And so in insects, they've lost all of those in the abdomen. And in arachnids and other things, they've also lost these appendages on the abdomen. And then in each segment, also, you've got a set of neurons called a ganglion. So each segment kind of has its own little brain that runs the appendage or other bits coming off of that. Wings, in the case of flying insects. And the ganglia have also been combined in some insects and some arthropods via tagmosis. So the older or more basal insects do have ganglion in each segment. But when you get to more derived insects like flies, they've, in addition to combining all of the segments of the abdomen together, they've kind of combined all the ganglia of the abdomen into one ganglia up front.
So older, more primitive insects like a dragonfly might have more brains than a more modern insect like a fly or a wasp?
Yes. It's important to know that they have one big ganglia brain at the front in the head.
Right.
So that really is the brain, but they've also got these other little bundles of nerves that, you know, they don't independently control the legs, but they act as kind of another way to control the legs.
I got you. They're relay stations.
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it.
Okay. So multiple brains in these segments. What else do you want to talk about with the segments?
Each one also have spiracles or breathing tubes. It's an opening in the body where air comes in and out. And again, in some of the segments, these have been lost or combined. But if you look at, say, a grasshopper, again, they'll have these spiracles on each segment to let air in and out of the body.
So let's cover these three things that we've been discussing again. We've got three main traits that we have discussed thus far. We've got the jointed appendages, we've got exoskeletons, and we've got distinct body segmentation. So very clearly different from us and from the other chordates with a lot of these things. What is it about these traits that have allowed the arthropods to be so successful? If I remember correctly, we're talking about 80% of animal life on Earth exists in this one category. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that's astounding when you really think about it. With all the time that we've had on planet Earth for evolution and adaptation to happen, are these three things that special that they've allowed the arthropods to succeed so well, or what is it, do you think?
It's a combination of these defining arthropod traits and other things. All of these traits, especially the exoskeleton, but also the fact that it had appendages on every segment, kind of pre-adapted arthropods to life on land. And so they were the first things after plants to invade land from the ocean. So the exoskeleton helped them avoid desiccation. The legs gave them a way to locomote on land, unlike our fishy ancestors that kind of had to co-opt their fins into limbs. They already had limbs that worked fine on land. And so they've just been on land a whole lot longer and been able to diversify that much longer than other things.
Okay. They got a head start on us is what you're saying.
They did. And from everything that we can tell from fossils and looking at genes, we think that arthropods invaded land around 420 million years ago. So We also have fossil tracks from 450 million years ago that may have been made by terrestrial arthropods as well. So they've been basically they invaded land, and that gave them a lot more niches to exploit once they got out of the ocean.
Yeah, they get up on land and they find plants, different kinds of plants. They find each other. There's all kinds of resources and little jobs to exploit, the niches to exploit. And it just led to this proliferation, a kind of explosion of life about, what'd you say, 420 or so million years ago. But when we start talking about this fossil record, can we talk about where did arthropods come from? What was before arthropods? You talked about exoskeletons and jointed appendages gave them a leg up, so to speak, but when they got up onto land. But what were they before they came onto land then?
I mean, the problem when you're talking about things before arthropods, it's like saying what came before chordates. So, you know, there were animals around, but you're so far back that all of these stem organisms are really hard to classify because they've either died out and there's no lineage left that looks anything like them, or they have diverged. You know, one thing has diversified into all of arthropods. And so you're getting back before these really big splits took place, or right around the time these really big splits took place in life. And so it's really hard to say, because we don't really have a good classification system necessarily for things that old. I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of the famous Burgess Shale Formation that was laid down around 500 or so million years ago. It's found up in Canada. And there are identifiable arthropods from the Burgess Shale, including a famous fossil called Borrelia. And we can put some links up to images of it in the show notes.
Absolutely.
And even further back, during the Ediacaran, 555 million years ago, there are some fossils that have been proposed to be arthropods. We think may or may not be arthropods. And it's kind of getting at that point where, you know, they might be arthropods. They might have been some closely related lineage that died out and didn't leave any descendants. They might be something completely different that doesn't really have a good analog today, but we're just not sure what it is. So...
But these things that we're talking about now that we find in the Burgess Shale, these were still aquatic organisms, right?
Yeah, so these are all aquatic up until about 420 million years ago. So you've got about 100, 130 million years of evolution where arthropods were constrained to the water.
And with all of that diversity that's going on in the water, you're saying that before we get to that point, it's almost impossible for us to say definitively what arthropods were. Like where they came from.
Yeah, it's not impossible necessarily, but we're still looking for good fossils. And that's part of the problem is you're getting back so far that good fossils are harder and harder to find because, you know, the parts of the crust of the earth that are that old, lots of it has been recycled. Mm-hmm. And so we've lost those fossils and just trying to find good fossil localities is difficult. But again, you're also talking at these super high levels of life that, you know, trying to puzzle out, well, did this fossil that I'm looking at, is it related to anything that we know today? Is it just some lineage that died out and didn't leave any descendants? And it's difficult to tease apart.
But it's also very interesting, I think, to think about, like, did they come from this one weird worm thing or what was the first sort of lineage of arthropods. I'm excited for the possibility that we can figure that out definitively someday. Maybe we all have to talk to the afterlife to find out, though. So when we talk about the fossil record, and you've mentioned it a couple times, there was all this diversity in the water, and then some of it started coming onto land. Do the arthropods that we know today, did they diversify from the land-based arthropods? Like, did some of them return back to the water and become the crustaceans and things that we know today? Or are there sort of dueling arthropod lineages?
Okay. So I guess the first thing to sort out or to say then is that there are four major subphyla.
Okay.
Of five major subphyla of arthropods. The trilobites, which are all extinct, unfortunately. I would love to see a living trilobite, they're all gone. The chelicerates, which are things like arachnids, so spiders, scorpions. The meristemata, which are the horseshoe crabs, and then pycnogonids, which are sea spiders. The next major subphylum are the myriapods, so things like centipedes, millipedes, and a few other groups. The crustaceans, which you've mentioned. So these are things most people are familiar with, like fairy shrimp that you might feed to your fish, barnacles, lobsters, crabs, regular shrimp, and then a few other groups. And then finally, the hexapods, so insects and things that are closely related to insects. And so crustaceans are mostly aquatic in salt water. The hexapods are mostly terrestrial in freshwater. Myriapods and chelicerates. Myriapods are almost entirely terrestrial, and then the chelicerates are almost entirely terrestrial, except for the pycnogonids and the horseshoe crabs.
Right.
And so I say all of that because you ask where they came from. The thinking now is that the hexapods arose somewhere within crustaceans. So it looks like the crustaceans, which occur in salt water, gave rise to all of these things that occur in terrestrial environments.
And then
it also looks that myriapods and chelicerates also independently invaded land from most likely saltwater ancestors.
So the trilobites came before all of these? Is that why they're extinct, or why is that they're gone?
No, the trilobites were around with everything else. The trilobites first occurred sometime in the early Cambrian, around 520 million years ago. So right around the time that all of the other kind of stem arthropods were diversifying, and we have records for them. And then they were some of the most successful animals for over 270 million years until they finally went extinct during the mass extinction of the Permian around 250 million years ago. We don't really, at least I don't know why trilobites went extinct. One thought is that you have more and more fish evolving, and so it may have been competition from fish that finally drove them to extinction. But regardless, we don't have them anymore, which is a shame.
I have one sitting on my shelf over here, but yeah, nothing that we can pet.
No. And nothing that you can get DNA out of either.
Oh, well, that's too bad. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. You talked about these four main subphyla. Do we have these subphyla separated out sort of anatomically, or are they separated out genetically nowadays? Have we done more phylogenetics on this?
Both.
Okay.
Arthropod taxonomy has been contentious up through the advent of genetic technology. So my suggestion earlier that hexapods, so insects and closely related groups, are actually coming from within crustaceans is kind of a newer idea that's been backed up by some genetic evidence. So it might be that we're actually breaking hexapods out incorrectly and that they're just highly derived crustaceans. In addition to genetic evidence, each one of them has morphological features that defines the groups. So hexapods, insects, and things like springtails are defined by having three body segments, the head, thorax, and abdomen. And their first pair of appendages are antennae. So they have modified their first pair of appendages on the head into these sensing organs for feeling and chemoreception. Chelicerates, on the other hand, have two major body segments, that the head or cephalothorax and the abdomen, and their first pair of appendages are the fangs. So rather than trying to sense the world first, they're just trying to eat the world first.
I like that approach better.
Yeah. You like that approach better, but hexapods are much, much, much more diverse. So evolution would say maybe the hexapods had a better idea.
That's a good point.
Myriapods. So these are things. These are things like millipedes, centipedes, parapods, which is parapods and some phyla, which are two other groups that look like millipedes and centipedes. These have a head and then the body, and the body is many segments. Each one has an appendage, unlike the chelicerates and the hexapods. They also have antennae as their first segment. And then the last group, the crustaceans, they have a whole bunch of different kind of body plans and have co-opted appendages to do different things. And honestly, I'm not as familiar with crustaceans as I am with the other groups. So I'm just going to leave it at that.
We know they're delicious. That's what we know about them.
They are delicious. They're also quite diverse.
Yes. That has been the one that I've had a tough time. So the goal of this show is the beginning of a sort of series here that we're going to call Arthropods 101. And I want experts on all of these different classes, or not classes, but subphyla that we're talking about. And crustaceans have been a difficult one for me to find somebody who lists themselves on a web page as a crustaceans expert. So, well, if you know anybody.
They're so diverse, it's difficult. It's like saying, well, I'm an expert in insects, but also all of these other groups, because, you know, most people that work on crustaceans just work on one of the subgroups.
All of these groups, we can look at their body plans and sort of figure out what it is that we're looking at. If we were going to go through and point to some examples, I think you've done a really good job of that so far on the show. So hexapods, that's all of your insect friends that you see out there, like a grasshopper. The crustaceans on land, you could meet a pill bug, right? That's
about it for land crustaceans.
Myriapods, millipedes, and centipedes that get into your homes, and chelicerata, any spiders that make their way into your home. So these are things that are present in your life. You may not know them by these particular names, but it's an important thing to learn about, not only because they're part of our lives, but it gives you a better understanding of the web of life. Is that a fair way of putting it, Mike?
Yeah, at least this large section of the web of life. You're not getting things like bacteria or chordates here, but I mean, you're talking about 80% of animal life, so it's quite substantial, yes.
And understanding how we put these things together a little bit makes you understand the way the world ticks a little bit better. I think, at least. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I mean, it makes just life more interesting. You know, instead of going out and being out in the world, you can, in ignoring them, you can, you know, see all of these arthropods all around you, and it kind of opens your perspective up to what surrounds you every day. It's like when you learn the plants in the woods, instead of seeing this, you know, just green backdrop, you see all of the intricacies of all of the different plants out there. And similar with arthropods, when you start looking at them, you can see all the different intricacies and things that, you know, intersect with your own life every day.
And this is sort of one of your life goals, right? This is your job in a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, at least it will be soon.
You're part of the scientific cohort that is trying to strip this apart and figure out these relationships a little bit better. At least that's how I describe you to other people. Is that not how you think of yourself?
No, I like that. I like that. Kind of on the forefront of knowledge with what's out there.
Yeah, it's just, I think it's of the utmost importance that we continue to learn about these connections, these evolutionary relationships. And I think that this plays into appreciating not only nature around you, but the museums and things that you can visit. Do you think that's a fair statement to say?
It's not necessarily just the diversity that makes insect collections in arthropod collections important. I mean, it is. It's certainly good to have large representation of diversity in the museum, but there's also other things that make a museum important. For instance, you have a time capsule to the past. You can, if you have a good collection from an area for bumblebees, then that will tell you what was in the what was present there in the past, and you can get, use it to compare with what's there's what is there in the present, and use that to make inferences about things like habitat change or climate change or that kind of thing. So it's not just that museums are these repositories of just diversity, but they are, but you can also use them to ask and answer all of these other questions as well.
We've covered a lot of ground here on the show today, I think. We tried to make a welcome to arthropods. It's a complex topic. We've covered, what, 400 or so million years of evolutionary history on the show, and there's a lot to unpack there. This will probably have the longest show notes of any episode in arthropod history, but I just want to summarize everything for the listeners at home today. Not everybody that listens to the show is an entomologist, I don't think. So let's summarize again just what we've talked about. First things first, what is the phylum that we're talking about?
Arthropoda.
And what is a phylum?
It's one of the higher groupings in taxonomy.
Okay.
So it would be equivalent to chordates for mammals.
And if we were going to list, like, maybe the three characteristics that we want to point to and say these are the defining traits of arthropods, what did we cover here today?
We talked about jointed appendages, body segmentation, and exoskeletons. I should note that there are other defining traits of arthropoda that we didn't cover.
True.
That are interesting and would be good for another discussion someday, such as the fact that they have a hemiseal, which is this open body cavity. They just, all of their organs are just kind of bathed in insect blood. They don't really have a closed circulatory system like we do. And some other funky things, like they have a ventral nerve cord and a dorsal heart, which is the exact opposite of the way humans are. We have a dorsal nerve cord. So there's other things that define arthropod that we didn't really have a chance to talk about.
I think bathed in insect blood is my new band name after you said that. So we talked about jointed appendages, body segmentation, and exoskeletons. We discussed the evolutionary history of insects. They are difficult to pin down in terms of their origin, but some of their earliest common ancestors probably looked like a millipede. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, probably. At least as far as we can tell.
And as we understand it currently, what are the main subphylums of arthropoda?
The main subphyla right now are the chelicerates, so spiders, scorpions, horseshoe crabs, and sea spiders. The myriapods, millipedes, centipedes, and their relatives. The crustacean, so brine shrimp, horseshoe shrimp, lobsters, crabs, barnacles. And then the hexapods, which are insects and their kin. Though, like I noted before, there is some thought that the hexapods have arisen from within crustaceans, so they might just be highly derived crustaceans themselves.
And that is a contentious issue, I think, that's discussed in a Nature paper.
Probably.
Yeah, Nature or Science. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. So there's a ton of stuff there. We didn't get to unpack it all completely fully, but I wanted this to be an introduction to this interesting group, this group that touches all of our lives. I wanted to say thanks to Mike, and I wanted to ask your opinion on where should I go next? What group should we start with here, these subphyla? What should be the next focus of Arthropod 101?
Oh, man. I mean, I know I'm an entomologist and I cut my teeth on insects, but I have a soft spot for the chelicerates.
Okay.
There's so many. It's a group that has been racked by extinction, so we don't have a lot of the really cool groups left. But what groups are here are really neat. And a couple of, and many of them, most people haven't heard of. So lots of people have heard of most of the common insect groups, but aside from spiders and scorpions, a lot of the chelicerate groups are small and tropical, and even seasoned entomologists either haven't heard of them or seen them in life. So you get some really neat stuff.
Okay, that's what we'll do then next. Next, we're going to go into the chelicerata. We're going to talk to an expert in that field. I'll have to line somebody up here in the next few weeks, but that is going to be the next set of Arthropod 101. We're going to be discussing spiders, mites, ticks, sea scorpions, horseshoe crabs, the whole shooting caboodle, hopefully. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. Join us in a couple of weeks or a month or so for another episode of Arthropod. and you'll be getting to learn about all of those many-legged, Calycera-bearing creatures.
Thanks for listening.